playing an important role in that compassionate response. The world has taken notice, and the American people are grateful.
That was President Bush speaking yesterday in Washington about the efforts of relief workers and the tsunami relief that's taking place not only in this country but worldwide. We're going to spend the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. today in conversation with Pastor Matt Harrison, who has just returned. I'm amazed that he's with us today, given the fact that he's probably somewhat jet-lagged. He's just returned from Sri Lanka, and after viewing and meeting with not only the damage there, but also meeting with the victims of the tsunami there. We're going to be talking with him about the relief efforts, and in particular the relief efforts of Lutheran World Relief, in the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. He's executive director of LCMS World Relief and Human Care. In the next hour, that is starting at 3:30 and running until 4:30, we're going to have a little bit of open lines for your questions and your comments. If you heard the question yesterday we ended the show with, I want your answer to that question. You've had 24 hours to consider this. You've got a kid that's in grade school, a son, or maybe a grandson, and you're wondering, what will he be when he grows up? What's he going to do? What will that career be? What if your son wanted to become a pastor? Pastors aren't well paid. That profession is dropping in its public esteem. Not a lot of respect for the pastoral office, and there are other downsides to it as well. What would you do if your son or your grandson wanted to be a pastor? Would you actively encourage or discourage him to do that? If you don't have any sons, what if your daughter wanted to marry a pastor? I went to a parochial college. Lots of girls who came out of pastors' families, lots of them didn't want to marry pastors. If you ask them why, their answer, pastors don't make any money. Oddly enough, a lot of those girls ended up marrying Lutheran parochial school teachers who make even less. Just an irony there. That question for you: your son wants to be a pastor, your daughter wants to marry a pastor, what do you do about it? That's from 3:30 to 4:30, open lines, Issues, etc. From 4:30 to 5, we'll be talking about Christianity and science with Dr. John Galt of Missouri Valley College. Are the two in conflict? How do Christians approach science and the findings of science without compromising the facts of their faith? Then, in the last hour of the program, Joel Osteen. We'll be hearing from him, evaluating his message on joy. Joel has a recipe for joy. And he says it's important that you have joy, otherwise the devil will get the better of you. You've got to keep your joy, and you can't let others or your circumstances or anything steal your joy. We'll hear what he has to say about that. Evaluate his sermon from Lakewood Church in Houston, Texas, largest megachurch in the United States, in the last hour of Issues, etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Feel free to join us. Pastor Matt Harrison is Executive Director of LCMS World Relief and Human Care, a regular guest, and he has recently returned from Sri Lanka after viewing the devastation following the tsunami. Matt, welcome back.
Thanks, Todd. Always great to be with you.
What did you see, and what did you hear from those with whom you met in Sri Lanka?
It's absolutely beyond belief. We flew in straight from Detroit to Paris, and then Paris straight to Colombo, capital of Sri Lanka. We arrived about 6:15 a.m., quickly connected with a local Lutheran pastor, a partner of ours, and we headed off down the coast south and right away began viewing the destruction. The 30,000 death toll doesn't even begin to tell the story. The nation, I think, is in some ways deceptively normal-looking until you begin to see the devastated areas and begin to talk to people who have been affected, lost entire families, some of them. Everybody on the coast has been affected horribly. Many communities lost, even though a life might not have been lost in a fishing community, every home destroyed. Those homes that weren't destroyed filled up with 5 feet of water, and it is an unbelievable tragedy, the likes of which I don't think I'll ever see again in my life.
And when we hear about the relief efforts, one thing I've commonly heard from people who have been on the ground there is that they have nothing to compare this with in terms of what needs to be done. It's not just that we need this or that. We need everything, and we need it all at once. Is that pretty accurate?
Well, I think the gist of the statement is accurate. I took Reverend John Temple from Ladue with me. He had spent 13 years in Sri Lanka as missionary and knows Sri Lanka like few other Lutherans in the United States. And it was his impression, and also mine, that the government is actually coping with this in an amazingly good way. The NGO, non-governmental organization community, and the governmental communities have relief coming in. 57 jet airplanes landed in the Colombo airport the day we landed, bringing relief. It was stacked up on the runway for a quarter mile. However, you can never, I cannot imagine that all the relief in the world could ever finally be enough. There are so many people affected in such remote places that they're right now beginning to get aid. So I think the government effort is going well. There's just an enormous amount of work to do.
I think you appeared on the news both before and after your trip to Sri Lanka, the television news here in the St. Louis market, and I remember you saying something about this really being a long haul, a very long-term effort of relief and care and help. Tell us about that.
It is. When disasters occur, they grab the attention. We call it the CNN effect. They grab the attention of the media, and that immediately grabs the hearts of people. And many people give emotionally, as these kind of events affect us all. They give immediately. But as soon as this disaster begins to move out of the headlines, and that will happen over the next month or so, then needs, long-term needs, are largely forgotten. And the first step in disaster response is just to make sure the essentials are there. One individual that one of our team members heard from simply said, we need underwear and Bibles. I mean, you can't imagine anything more basic than the people needing those two things. You move out from food, water, just the basic shelter needs covered, and then from that point you move to psychological needs, and then you're looking at temporary housing while you're looking toward reconstruction, and long-term needs, job needs, the whole realm of human needs. And to take a community through development, self-help, so it can be self-sustaining, means accompanying a community for a long time.
I think I heard you mention before you went to Sri Lanka that the president of a sister body to the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod, a clergyman and his wife, had lost their life in the tsunami when the train that they were riding was derailed and destroyed. Is that correct?
That is correct. We traveled south on the coast, and I wanted especially to see that train. And we came upon the area. About 1,000 people lost their lives right there. It was a low-lying area. The train ran, the coastal train at that point, ran about, I'd say, a half mile or so away from the beach, inland. The first wave struck at about 10 feet tall, from what I'm told. That did not remove the train from the rails. It did begin to destroy homes around the train. A number of people then climbed on top of the train to avoid the water. Another wave at 30 or 40 feet then followed and simply rolled the train through some of the cars on top of houses behind, left six rows of really quite nice brick homes absolutely devastated. Just all you have left are pads of cement with maybe floor tiles wiped absolutely clean, and piles of rubbish in between, piles of bricks and everything you can imagine from life. And those people, some 800 people, were swept away and swept to the south, many of them found in the destroyed homes, and others swept out the river back to the sea. In fact, while I was there, there were bodies being found.
How much of that is still a concern? And that is one of the more difficult things to hear about. First of all, in the days that immediately followed the tsunami, they were digging and preparing mass graves because of just the sheer number of dead They could not deal with them in any orderly way except to do that, also to keep disease down. To what degree is it still these sad pictures of people looking at photographs posted on walls in the city of dead bodies trying to identify their loved ones?
I think in the areas that we saw, virtually all of the burials had occurred. The number of bodies being found has slowed to a trickle, and they are being buried one by one. It's a solemn. I walked around the train, one of a handful of whites, as a number of others walked around surveying the cars which had been pulled back up on the track. And there was just a complete somber mood as we walked around. I took photographs, yet there were no local objections to that at all. I think the Sri Lankan people are enormously thankful that the world community has taken an interest in this terrible, terrible tragedy. I watched as the locals removed their rubber gloves and threw them in a Walmart bag. I think Walmart probably sent things over to help with the recovery. And these men all masked because of the disease problems and also just simply the stench were slowly, one by one, peeling off after a day of search. And to think that Pastor Ranjit, who had just translated the Book of Concord for the Lutheran Heritage Foundation, had lost his life there. He was identified only by one shoe, which was the only bit of clothing that remained on his body. And it is indeed hard to comprehend the will of the Lord at times. Spiritual father, founder, and head of that small church body.
That's what I think most people are curious about, whether they be religious or irreligious. Questions of a theological nature are just the most pressing, probably, at a time like this. Put this into its proper context. If something like this, the unimaginable scale, the human toll, can even be put into a context that we can grasp, give it a shot.
Well, it's interesting. I asked just about everybody I talked to do just that. I talked to Hindus, majority Buddhists. I talked to Christians, Roman Catholic Christians. The fishermen that are affected are almost all Roman Catholics. Individuals said, I have no answer for this. Some of the Hindus spoke of karma and the bad karma of those who were destroyed as though this was something that, in fact, it deserved. Others speak of them being good people and therefore taken away and the evil left behind in a kind of an inverted theology of karma. I heard on the way over, the Southern Baptist gentleman, a very fine gentleman involved in rescue efforts, tell me that the way that he had heard many people were evangelizing very effectively, at least they thought effectively, was to say, you know, did your Hindu gods or did your Buddhist philosophy keep you from being destroyed? Well, then you should look to another god. And that theology of glory I found intensely problematic and repulsive even. The only thing I could find, and this is the way it always is, I was in a fishing village that had been completely destroyed. We had spent an hour or more with a family there telling us, and you'll find the Sri Lankans just simply want and need to tell the story of what they were doing when the water receded and when the first wave came and what they did to flee and what happened when the second wave came and which children they pulled together and how they found their wife. And this man, after this long conversation, gave me a crucifix, which was one of the few things which remained of his destroyed house. And I find meaning in this kind of disaster only in the cross of Christ and only in the fact that our Lord, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost reveals himself in the midst of crosses and suffering most profoundly.
Pastor Matt Harrison is our guest, Executive Director of LCMS World Relief and Human Care. We're talking about tsunami relief efforts. in about 10 minutes. We'll start open lines for your questions and your comments here on Issues, Etc. Matt, you mentioned just a second ago a Baptist minister who had talked about this quote-unquote evangelistic approach. Did your Hindu gods, did your Buddhist gods, did your Muslim god protect you from this? Obviously no. Therefore, you should buy into the Christian god. And the implied thing is, well, then if you do that, then you won't be the victim of a tsunami.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond just the kind of rank superstition that lurks beneath an idea like that, you mentioned a theology of glory.
Mm-hmm.
Explain what you mean by that, and why do you find that so repugnant?
Well, we often find that popular theologies always want to tell us that if we make the right decisions about God and we get our lives in order, then things will go well with us in this life. Sounds just wonderful, and we can pat ourselves on the back and disciple all kinds of other non-believers into this kind of glorious life. The only problem is the Bible doesn't support it at all. Now, there are passages in the Old Testament, Proverbs, etc., that give us wisdom about life, and if we live in a sane way, avoiding gross error and sin, our lives will be spared a lot of difficulty. However, I guess if you want to ask whether living a sinless life in conformity with God's will is going to get you a wonderful, sufferingless life, you just need to look at the cross. You just need to look at the apostles. Every one of them died a violent death. You need to read the New Testament in Hebrews 12, which talks about suffering and how God uses it in his purposes. You need to look at all those places in the New Testament which tell us we, if we suffer with Christ, we therefore be glorified with Christ. And numerous passages which talk about the salutary and important theological nature of suffering as a constituent part of being a Christian, which God uses and God brings.
These tidal waves hit the day after Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And for many, it was a time where they were already gathered with family. Here in America, we were enjoying, even the poorest among us, were enjoying our own versions of opulence. And this news was not only sobering, but it was also, a source of perspective that we seldom get in our insular society. Mm-hmm. Was it the same for you?
You know, I had just returned from a Kenya trip, and that is sobering enough. And had gotten a little time off, was spending it with my relatives, and all of a sudden I was watching Fox News, and here comes the report of the tsunami, and the numbers just started coming out, and I just grew in my disbelief until finally we were hearing these astronomical numbers, and I felt like when I was a pastor in the parish for 10 years, you know, when somebody, I know you had the same experience, somebody is suffering or in the hospital or dying or in terrible need, and you just know as a pastor that you just need to go. You need to go. And I just had the sense that in this work, I needed to go. I needed to have a firsthand look, tell our partner churches how much we care about them and love them and are willing and able and going to help them and are helping them. And then we had to look at a strategy. In fact, we got a team out in Sri Lanka right now in some of the remote areas looking at how we can build the capacity of our Sri Lankan partner church so we can reach out to other Christians, Lutherans, and non-Christians in several villages on the coast.
And since these stories we here in the United States have been watching very small versions of the same thing taking place out on the West Coast with heavy rainfall and things like that. Just last night, my wife and I were watching the news, and they led the news with just an entire hillside of homes sliding off into a canyon that was just filled with water. And for some, it's a mere inconvenience. For others, they are losing their lives and their livelihoods as well. And I could not help but think we are living on a planet that is in turmoil, that is groaning in the expectation of Christ's return.
It is indeed. And Paul describes it well in Romans chapter 8. And nevertheless, in that same chapter, he says, all things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. There is there's something about these disasters which is simply God's alien work. It is his unfathomable control of the events of the world, which serves his purposes, which only he knows fully. Yet we know these things are to remind us of our own mortality and drive us to him for comfort and consolation, and to drive us to recognize the fantastic blessings we have in this life, to live the way we do with the blessings of this country, with our families, our unbelievable, unbelievable gifts. And then he gives us opportunities to be generous, to love, to live outside of ourselves, to find joy in caring for other people and their needs. That's what it's all about.
Matt, with only a minute here, right after the tsunamis, I was listening to a nationally syndicated talk show. They were talking about all of these things, the relief efforts. A caller right out of the Midwest called in and said, look, if anyone was looking for proof positive that we live in a world of blind chance with no God, that no one is in charge, here it is. There's no denying it. We are alone. That was the caller's conclusion after this. How would you respond?
Oh, what utter tragic nihilism. The heavens declare the glory of the Lord, and that if you looked at this from an apologetic vantage, the earth, even in the midst of this chaos, the earth betrays absolutely marvelous order. The universe betrays absolute marvelous clockwork order, and it betrays the hand of an orderly, intelligent creator. And I would say, far from this kind of nihilism, this kind of event, just like 9/11, this kind of event brings out more love. Even if you're talking in sort of non-theological kingdom of the left terms, it brings out more decency, more love, more mercy, compassion, and exercise of the best of the human spirit than anything else that ever happens. And so I think you can even make a secular argument for the benefit of disaster very easily. And beyond that, these kind of disasters point us to the suffering and death of Jesus and the hope of his resurrection as the kernel, the core of our hope for all of life. And that faith has grabbed me, it's grabbed you, and it's grabbed all of our listeners. And I shall never be a nihilist, not by the grace of God, never, ever.
Pastor Matt Harrison, thank you very much, and keep up the good work. We hope to hear from you again soon on this, as it remains an ongoing concern. Pastor Matt Harrison, the Executive Director of LCMS World Relief and Human Care, thank you again for being here.
Hey, thanks, Todd. It's always great to be with you. I'll be on Channel 2 in the morning at 7:15 on the television, so
we'll
direct your readers there, and we look forward to chatting to you again soon.
We'll be looking for you there on Channel 2 tomorrow morning. And when we come back, I'll tell you about how you can find out more about helping support tsunami relief efforts through the outreach of LCMS World Relief. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Matthew's gospel contains a lot of Jesus' teaching. But how do these long sections of teaching from our Lord relate to the end of Matthew's gospel, where Matthew tells us about Jesus' suffering, death, and resurrection for a sinful world? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for January is called Discourses in Matthew by Dr. David Scare. Discourses in Matthew is $29.99 plus shipping and handling. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and look under the What's New section for more information on the Issues, Etc. book of the month for January, Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church by Dr. David Scare, or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues, Etc. book of the month for January, Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church.
Families looking to make money in the cities wind up trapped in poverty. This Global Minute invites you to focus prayer on Manila, capital city of the Philippines. Jeff Anderson of Action International Ministries says families end up in the slums because they're unprepared for urban living.
Families come to the city thinking there's greener pastures, so to speak, but there really isn't. They lack the urban skills, they lack education, they lack job opportunities, so they end up in what we call squatter areas or slums.
Jeff and his wife, Marianne, have worked in the Philippines for many years, and they help form a network of local churches caring for the poor. The efforts today are led by Filipino Christians. Pray Christians will help the poorest of families to find hope through Jesus Christ. Action International wants you to know there's something you can do to help others around the world. Visit the website actionintl.org, actionintl.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Today, the Senate Judiciary Committee is scheduled to hold a hearing on asbestos liability legislation. Last week, President Bush visited Madison County, Illinois. The county dubbed the nation's judicial hellhole because of enormous liability awards. Wrangling about liability reform is just one part of our changing culture, and all those cultural changes are being sought or fought in the courts. Phoebe Perkins, a New Testament scholar, describes first century Palestine as an ailing social system and a society in which established ties were generally fragile. Then she quotes scholar Richard Fenn. The Jesus movement may have played a significant role precisely in this new birth of new roles and networks through forms of speech that left little doubt as to what was said or done. That is, in that time of cultural confusion, 1st century A.D., Christians played a positive role by speaking and acting in sincere and authentic ways. Critics of Christianity, specifically critics of Paul and Silas, said, "These men have turned the world upside down," Acts 17:6. Upside down or right side up? What holds more hope for our radically changing culture? Christians speaking and acting in sincere, authentic ways? Or legal wrangling? Can we learn from history?
DKFU. DKFU.
Folks, coming off that conversation with Pastor Matt Harrison of LCMS World Relief and Human Care, if you'd like to find out more about how you can help support tsunami relief efforts through the outreach of LCMS World Relief, visit the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org. When you get there, you might notice that the website has been revamped a little bit, I think a little easier to use. The What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org, or you can make a credit card donation to LCMS World Relief in the next 45 minutes. That's until 4:15. Call this toll-free number to make that donation for tsunami relief, 1-888-930-4438. That's 1-888-930-4438, and ask to support tsunami relief efforts. The website address again, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section to donate online or call 1-888-930-4438 in the next 45 minutes. That's until 4:15. It's open lines for the next hour of the program. Now, I've got the question, and this question is one of those that opens like a flower. We were talking about this, in fact, and that's where the question came from. If your son wanted to become a pastor... I've got a son who's 8 years old. My wife and I the other night were sitting around saying, what do you think he's going to be when he grows up? And neither of us, he's got a lot of talents. He's musically talented. He has a real head for math. I've talked to him about becoming an engineer. Well, his grandfather was an engineer. One of his uncles is an engineer. It's a good, steady career. It's a career that evolves over time. It's the kind of thing, if my son, I'd like to say, my son the engineer. But what if my son came to me as a young child, he's eight, what if in a couple of years he came to me and said, Dad, you're a pastor. I want to be a pastor. Okay, there he is. He's dreaming. He's hoping. He's thinking about being a pastor. If your son came to you with the same words, Mom, Dad, I want to be a pastor, would you actively encourage him to do this as a young child. Okay, your son's older. Maybe he's getting ready to go into college, or he's in the middle of college. And he's pursuing a degree in law, or he's pursuing a degree toward medical school or some other profession. And he said, I've thought it over, and I'm going to change directions. I want to change my major. I want to go into the ministry. I want to be in a pastor. Your son, your grandson. Now, see, he's not 8 years old. You don't have 10 years to think about it. You don't have 10 years to kind of convince him of something else or to encourage him. Would you actively encourage your son to become a pastor in that circumstance? Or maybe you don't have a son or a grandson. You've got a daughter. And this daughter has met a young man in college, and he's going to be a pastor. Or she meets some guy out there after she's left college, and he is a pastor, and she wants to marry him. You know, pastors don't get paid very much, generally speaking. The public respect for the pastoral office has been in steady decline over the last 30 years or so. It's not one of those careers where, oh yeah, you start out making $25,000 a year, but if you work hard and apply yourself, you can end very comfortably. That's not the way it is, folks. If you're lucky, you might double that in the course of 30 years of ministry. So you don't start out making a lot. It's very tough. And you don't end making very much either. A lot of pastors, at least in previous generations, lived in somebody else's house. A parsonage. They don't even own their own home. And then when they retire, they got to buy their own home at retirement. And you're thinking, wow, is that what I want for my son? Is that what I want for my daughter if she's going to marry one of these guys? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You know, there's another factor here. Your friends. What are you going to tell the ladies at the Bridge Club? What are you going to tell the ladies in the Red Hat Society? What are you going to tell the men on the golf course when you say, well, what's your son doing? Oh, he's got a football scholarship, and then he's going to go to medical school. Wow, that's nice. What's your son going to do, Bob? He's going to be a pastor. Oh, really? Maybe he's, you know, obviously didn't have the football scholarship, and I guess Bob's son isn't smart enough for medical school. So instead of get a real job, he's going to become a pastor. You know, people will say that. Or let's look at it one other way. Let's say you're married to a man now, and you guys have a nice home, and the cars, and the kids are all in school, and your husband has a good career, and he's working hard, and he is right where he needs to be. He's making money. You're comfortable. And he comes to you one Sunday afternoon after church, and he says, honey, I've been thinking it over, and I have talked it over with pastor, and I think I want to go into the ministry. Now, it's going to mean going back to school for 4 years, and that's going to be very hard. And then after we get out of school, and it's also going to be expensive, after we get out of school, we're probably going to have to, our income will probably go down about 2/3 for the rest of our lives. And this house, these cars, those schools, we're not going to be able to keep doing this. I'd like to be a pastor. What would you say to your husband? Now, distinguish in your answer between two things. As a parent, do you want your kid to be a pastor? But there's a difference between someone saying, I'd like him to be a pastor, but are you going to encourage him, actively encourage him to be a pastor? That's my question for you. You'd had 24 hours to think it over. I mentioned it yesterday. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Or if you can think of some good reasons, how would you discourage him? And why? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'll give you an example, by the way. There's a gentleman I've been working on off and on, not so much lately, for a decade, who I think would make a dandy pastor. He loves God's word. He loves theology. I think he has all the prerequisite talents and skills for someone to study for the ministry. I've been encouraging him to do this in one way or another for a long time. He's a little bit older than I am. And while he hasn't wasted his talents or his skills, he has consistently said, I know that might be off in the future sometime, but I don't know if I can. And I don't think I can now. And that's fine. I've said, okay, you know, you have a vocation wherein God has called you and you serve God there. Fine and good. But bear in mind, I still think you'd make a good pastor. 505-7850-1800-730-2727. Let's start with Bill, who listens in Toma, Wisconsin on the internet. Bill, welcome.
Hi. Hi, Todd.
Hi, Bill.
I guess when that question first came up, I thought, well, I got three sons, by the way. So I'm a busy man. They're all under four. So, the thought of them becoming a pastor for, in my mind is very encouraging. But at the same time, I guess from my end, I see the time that a pastor would be able to spend with his family. I guess that's the one end that would, if I had to discourage my children, that's where I would bring that issue up.
Well, there is something that I hadn't thought about, but that's absolutely true. You know, you're thinking about, and it also goes to the question of the daughter wanting to marry a pastor. You say, well, okay, he's a fine fellow, but, you know, pastors spend a lot of time away from their family. And pastors, of necessity, sometimes their families do come second or even third. Those are all factors in there. So that would be one of the things that would give you a bit of pause?
Yeah, it would. Especially, I have two brothers that are pastors. One's in the Missouri Synod, one's in Wisconsin. And they put in a lot of hours, plus the two pastors I have in my congregation, they put in 80 to 90-hour weeks.
Yeah, they do.
And I just, even myself, I've looked into going into the pastoral ministry, but the talks my wife and I have had, we've kind of backed away from that because I cannot picture myself personally giving up the time that I spend with my kids now and going into the ministry. It's a tough thing to weigh out, I guess.
Bill, thank you very much for bringing that up, because that's really probably one of the more decisive factors in this whole thing. Are you going to encourage your son to become a pastor? If he's ready to change careers, if he's your husband or your son, he wants to change careers and become a pastor, are you going to encourage or discourage him to do that? A wife looking at her husband and says, honey, you get to come home every night and you get to spend the weekends with us, and now you tell me you want to be a pastor, take half the pay you're making, if that, now, move out of this house, sell these cars, take the kids out of the expensive schools, and I don't get to see you on the weekends or the evenings either? Those are valid concerns. 505-7850-1800-730-2727. Paul calls from his car. Paul, welcome.
Hi.
Hi, Paul.
Thanks for taking my call. I have an 11-year-old son who goes to a Lutheran school, and when he was younger, he, you know, said he wanted to be a pastor. I didn't really put much into that, but now, at 11, he's in confirmation. He's again stated that he would like to be a pastor, but his concern was about the family issue, about, you know, spending not much time. And so you brought that up, made sure he understood that, and I've encouraged him as much as I can. I just wanted to make sure that he knows everything, because I watch our pastors and I have him watch, and boy, you know, they do a lot. And I just encourage him and make sure he understands.
Paul, thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, so Paul, there you've got an 11-year-old son, and he is encouraging him, but this is a cautious encouragement. This isn't easy. Scripture is very clear about it. Paul says, if anyone desires to enter into the office of bishop, and he's talking there about pastor, he desires a noble task. But then there's also the very same epistles are full of, replete with warnings. Pastors held to a higher standard. Look at what Paul says of pastors here. All of these things that pastors must be. Those are not just, okay, here are the requirements. They're also, think twice before you do this. And he even tells Timothy, lay hands on no one quickly. Which is kind of a backhanded way of saying, not just anybody is fit for this task. And we're not talking about the intellect, the faith, or any, there are circumstances outside those things that also go to fitness for the ministry. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, from Louisiana, Missouri. Jane is on the line. Jane, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
Very well.
I'm on the outside edge of your listening area.
I know you are. You're way up there.
I'm a pastor's wife, and I have enjoyed spending our time and our children's time with the best and finest, honest Christian people all our whole married life. And one of our children is married to a pastor, and we just love that. The other daughter is married to a Lutheran music minister. It's just the best life, and when you see people's lives open up because they have faith in Christ, it's just the best time in the world.
Jane, thank you. Now, see, there you go. That's what people said. I remember I went to a small high school, so the people who are in your class, you will kind of stay, you don't stay in touch with them. I haven't stayed in touch with any of them, to tell you the truth, but that's just me. I don't burn bridges. I just don't ever build them. But I know everyone who I graduated with, and then we had a reunion, 20th reunion sometime back, and so my mom sends me all the pictures. I wasn't able to be there. And I'm looking at these pictures of these people, and what interests me more is, what are they doing? Especially the guys. What are they doing? Doctor, lawyer, stockbroker. A couple of them maybe are still, you know, kind of in the wandering stages. One of them might still be living with mom. Who knows? But and you naturally kind of rank yourself among those, especially when it's a small group. When your graduating class is 35 people. And I'll be honest with you. You say, okay, where do I fall in the continuum of how did they turn out? Those who were voted most likely to succeed, how did everyone succeed? Now, I know where probably my classmates, even though I don't, they remember me with affection or not remember me at all, but if they were to hear, hey, Wilkin became a pastor, say, I didn't expect that. They certainly would not have expected that. Last thing we expect him to do. But, you know, it's respectable. It's nice. That isn't that quaint kind of a thing. And I know what they picture when they hear Wilkin became a pastor. This is what they picture. There's Wilkin, less hair, more paunch, wearing one of those goofy pastors, you know, bad suit, clerical collar, brown shoes with a gray suit, thinning hair, big horn-rimmed glasses. That's true, but that's a fashion choice. And then a wife dressed in a frumpy denim dress, 16 children, homeschooling in the middle of Nebraska. That's what they picture. Now, none of that is true. My wife gave up wearing denim dresses a long time ago, and she's never been frumpy. And then I think to myself, and I'm just being completely honest with you folks, They'll hear in the alumni news that Wilkin hosts a nationally syndicated radio program. Oh, he's a pastor who hosts a radio program. Now that's different. That's different. Now I'm thinking about this in terms of being a parent. I've got two kids. One of them's a son. My son says I want to be a pastor. One of the things I will be thinking about, and I'm just being completely above board with you, is, well, he obviously is not going to be able to take care of me in my old age. I mean, he might be able to come and feed me, but he ain't going to be paying for anything. If my son comes to me and says, son, dad, I would like to be a brain surgeon, then I'm thinking, you know, I'm thinking condo in Florida. On my son's nickel, hopefully, right? So if your son came to you and said, I'd like to be a pastor, or I'm thinking about this, or even if they're little and they say, I'm going to be a pastor when I grow up, would you discourage them or encourage them? be honest, really. I mean, the callers so far have been very honest about it, the good and the bad, especially people, if you come to the conclusion that for one reason or another, you would discourage them from doing it. You know, there are some, when I told my parents that I was going to change from what I, well, I don't know, I wasn't planning on doing anything. I was going to be a teacher. And my parents were all, you know, I don't know how thrilled they were about it, but they have five sons, you see, and the others were turning out okay so far. So Todd can afford to be a teacher because you can always have one less stellar achievement in the family without suffering any loss of reputation. And then when I told them I wanted to be a pastor, now I might have just been reading too much into it, but they were not initially thrilled. When I said, I'm going to change majors and I'm going to go into pre-seminary studies to go to the seminary, I think it was one of those moments when you're on the phone with mom and dad and there's just silence for about 15 seconds. Now, they weren't unhappy about it, but they were, are you sure you want to do this? Is this something you really are? Now, they recovered very quickly, and they've just been thrilled about it ever since. What about you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. If your daughter came home and said, I'd like to marry this man who's 4 years old and still living with mom in the basement, you'd say, no, that's not a good idea. How many steps above the 40-year-old man living with mom in the basement is the pastor? And I say this as a pastor, where you know this is not going to be a lucrative or, in the eyes of the world, a successful career. Ann is calling from Crestwood, and welcome to Issues, Etc.
Oh, hi. Well, I would be one of those moms who would be thrilled to pieces because, well, first of all, that he wants to study, which my son didn't, and my son's a salesman. My husband and my son are both in the phone business, but my husband worked over 900 hours overtime last year. So my son would be used to not being home a lot if he decided to do that because his dad wasn't home a lot. But the whole idea as being a Christian is that we want to evangelize. And if I have a son that wants to teach other people about the Lord, then, and I consider that to be success in life. I don't look at success financially so much. I just can't think of anything better to be. But I would want him to be a Missouri Synod pastor or one that would teach in a Reformation way.
What do you think your friends, some of your friends or family members, what do you think they'd think about the decision of your son to become a pastor?
My mother, I think, would be thrilled, except she would prefer that he was a Catholic priest. And I don't think that they would look down on it. My son already, he's an anomaly to his friends because he's almost 23 and he doesn't drink or smoke or do drugs. So he's already something of an anomaly. Now, if I could just get him to go to church every single Sunday because he believes, but he's lazy. But if he ever decided to go into the seminary, I would be I'd be bowled over. It would be absolutely fabulous.
And thank you. Thank you very much. Well, let's see what else. Jim is on his car phone. Jim, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Pastor.
Hi.
I'm calling. I'm a second-year seminary student getting ready to go on the vicarage. And when I told my parents, initially I kind of had the same feeling as you did, that I was really kind of afraid to tell them. I had been thinking about going into veterinary medicine, and it was almost one of those things like I shouldn't be afraid, but I really was. But surprisingly, not just my parents, but my whole family, just when I told them, said, you know, that just is the perfect thing for you. And the real surprising thing is about half of my family, my mother's side of the family, is not religious at all. But they have just been extremely excited about this. So it's been a great thing for me and my wife as well.
Were you married when you made the decision, or did you get married after you made the decision to go to the seminary and become a pastor?
Oh, I got married about a month before we moved to St. Louis, and about a month before I started classes.
So she knew your wife knew going in, I'm marrying a future pastor.
Yeah, and the interesting thing, it was actually on the second date. I had told her, you know, if we want this to go any farther, she wasn't a Lutheran at the time. She was part of the Brethren Church, and second date, I told her, if we really want this to go any farther, you have to know I'm going to be a pastor, and you know, that would mean that you would have to convert to be a Lutheran as well. And she was okay with that, and her family was okay with that. I don't think that's really a normal reaction that a lot of other people would have, but for us, it's just been great. And she's taken on to the role very, very well so far, just being very supportive of me. And her family is very supportive, although they don't really understand all what it is to be Lutheran. And when they've seen me a few times in my collar, it's kind of weird for them coming from a really much different tradition.
Jim,
it's a good thing.
Jim, thank you. Thank you. See, that's the reaction my parents gave me was, okay. Then later they said, we should be happy about this. Now we're happy about it. And they've been happy about it ever since. They really have. Nora's calling from St. Louis. Nora, our time is short here. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, if my son or one of my grandsons said he wanted to be a pastor, I would tell him to, I'd ask him whether he felt God was calling him to, and if he did, to pray about it, be sure God was calling him to it, and if so, go to it, because I think that you need to be called, you know, feel that that's what God wants you to do to be effective.
Nora, thank you. You know, I'm just trying to think about this in absolutely honest and realistic terms. For parents who've got little kids, a little boy who says, I'm going to grow up and be a pastor. Or a college-age son who says, okay, it's time to make a career decision. It's to the pastoral ministry for me. Or you've got a husband who's already got his career well-established, and he says, it's been nagging me for years. I'm going to do it. I'm going to go to the seminary. We're going to leave it all behind, literally, and I'm going to be a pastor. You know, a lot of parents, when they hear that news, it's kind of like their son coming home from college saying, I've decided to become a professional musician. Or I've decided to become an English major. And their parent and the parents think, well, he's doing what he loves, but he's never going to be able to find a decent job. I've decided to become an artist. See, that's why my parents got happy about me going into the pastoral ministry, because the choice before that was artist. And they realized that I would be living at home, probably with a wife and kids, too. So what do you do if your son wants to be a pastor? Do you encourage or discourage him? If your boyfriend decides that he's going to be a pastor, you thought he was going to be a vet, and suddenly he tells you, no, I've decided to be a pastor, is it time to start looking for a new boyfriend? When we come back, same question, your answers and your phone calls on Open Lines, Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.